fifth case, Green v. AFT, IFT Local 604.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Smith.
Please, Court. Michael Smith representing the appellant. We're before this court seeking a remand on Judge Norgal's granting of the summary judgment, which was basically on the pleadings before it. My client had filed a complaint against AFT, IFT for race discrimination, sex discrimination, and retaliation for prior protected conduct. The reason for that was that they hadn't processed certain grievances that he believed were important to him. There was remediation notices, which are notices of deficiency by the employee that they should have cleared up or modified their conduct. The issue in this particular case is that the remediation notices were like from 2000 and 2005, and he was seeking that the AFT, IFT file a grievance against the school district, trying to make it overturn those remediation notices because of that there was no notice dates for him to have cleared it up. So because of that, he had a current problem in 2010 where there was another remediation problem of excessive force. Now, based on that, there was a determination of his not being employed anymore by the school district and having a hearing. Well, within that concept, my client had asked AFT, IFT to properly represent him in that proceeding. The union then turned him down, indicating that they did not believe that they wanted to represent him because there was an adversarial relationship with him by the fact that he had filed a race discrimination against the union back in 2005. It's also quoted in the EEOC position statement by Gilbert Feldman, opposing attorney, that he had stated, "I could not have represented him, but elected not to because I have a deep bias against him as a result of him repeatedly being a pest in numerous situations in which I represented the union in response to his absurd claims against the union." I think it's almost apparent that they didn't, in their reply brief or response brief, even attend to the statements that we had made in our briefing.
What is the significance of those statements?
Well, I think the significant
they don't indicate race discrimination. They indicate pest discrimination.
Well, but there's
that
two.
May be
there's two points.
Ignoble of the union, but there's no federal rule against discriminating against pains in the butt.
Well, I think the words were chosen carefully so that they wouldn't say it's based on race or it's based on something else. But obviously the letter does amount to retaliation, at least, by the fact that he had previously run a discrimination complaint against the union. So it just seems apparent that based on...
What evidence of race discrimination do you have? What's your best evidence of race discrimination?
Well, we had comparables of a female and a male that the union had represented in... I guess the whole issue, Judge, is the union's position, and I think the court's position, was that they were looking at the Tenure Act, alleviated any potential responsibility of the union in which to represent the employee. The purpose of the Tenure Act is basically...
My question is, what is your best evidence of discrimination? I'm not asking about the purpose of the Tenure Act. What's your best evidence of discrimination?
As I stated, there were two comparables that were listed in our brief.
Saying I've got comparables is nothing. What's your best evidence of discrimination?
That they represented these other employees who were not of the protected class of my client. And I think also, as the court would look, this was a summary judgment on the pleadings that we didn't even have an opportunity to look into the comparables. So the court had initially denied a motion to dismiss, where it was brought because of the evidence that they had presented trying to show that they had no duty to represent my client. But I think the issue is that it became confused between, I think, the court looking at labor management, which was not really our complaint. Ours was really race discrimination or retaliation. Because I think if we look at the court seeing, is there a duty to represent, is not the issue. The issue is, was there discrimination by their failure to represent, not whether they had the discretion to not represent. I think that if we apply the O'Neill case, the airline pilots versus O'Neill, where we're looking at, is the action by the union arbitrary? I'd say it was. I mean, it's clear that they made it known that they weren't going to represent him. Second, we believe there was discrimination by the fact that the union had previously protected other employees not in his protected class. And we believe, based on just the letter, that it was in bad faith.
What does the record show about how many members of the union have been fired?
I don't have that information, Judge. I mean, basically...
The question, you point to two white teachers who the union represented in the statutory proceedings. Unless that's the numerator of something, we need to know, in order to figure out whether this is significant, the denominator as well.
Well, the only thing I can say, Your Honor, is I didn't have that opportunity to create the discovery. What had happened is that after the motion to dismiss, the court alluded to the fact that if you want to get the evidence in that you use in a motion for summary judgment, you need to do a motion to dismiss, you need to do it by way of summary judgment, which then they did. They filed an answer, and right after the answer, they filed the motion for summary judgment.
Did you file discovery requests that the district court prevented from being answered?
No, I didn't, Judge. I mean, at this point, the turnaround time was they filed a summary judgment at the same time they filed the answer.
Rules permit that, and the rule also, this is Rule 56E, says that if you can't respond to the summary judgment motion without discovery, you have to alert the district court by a filing under Rule 56E. Did you make a filing under Rule 56E?
No, I didn't. Okay. I might reserve my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Feldman.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel says the issue is not whether the union had any duty to represent him in this case, which was filed under the Illinois Tenure Act. And therefore, his arguments are all under the assumption that it is irrelevant whether the union had any duty
Indeed.
To represent.
Why does it matter whether the union has a duty? Suppose this were a lawsuit against an employer claiming race discrimination, and the job is employment at will. The employer has no contractual duty to maintain somebody, but if the employer fires a black at-will worker and keeps an equivalent white at-will worker, that's a violation of Title VII. Duty is irrelevant. Why should duty matter when the suit is against a union rather than an employer? Under Title VII, the union and the employer are treated the same way.
Yes, that is correct. And the short answer is, that the source of the responsibility of the employer and the source of the responsibility of the union are quite different. Union's responsibility is created by statute, and the question is...
No, that just assumes that duty matters.
Yes.
The claim in this case, as I understand it, is that the claim of discrimination is that the union, despite having no duty whatsoever, sometimes represented white employees in statutory proceedings and did not represent black employees. And that, at least to my ears, is a perfectly normal claim of race discrimination within the scope of Title VII. Is the union asserting that it has a right under Title VII to represent white employees and tell black employees to buzz off? Because that seems to be the right you're asserting.
that right has been established by the Labor Relations Board as you described it in the decision which is filed with you in the appendix, that it is where they hold that your
state. Title VII is not administered by either state or federal labor relations boards. It's administered by the judiciary. Is there some decision by the Seventh Circuit, or for that matter the Eighth, or the Sixth, or the Supreme Court, saying that a union can engage in intentional racial discrimination with respect to all those things where it has no statutory duty to represent the employee?
There is a case, my case, which goes back to 1973, which essentially decided this question, overruling my arguments. My arguments at that time were very similar to the arguments of the plaintiff here. In Airline Stewards and Stewardesses Association versus American Airlines, I argued essentially what plaintiff's counsel is arguing here. And Judge Fairchild's decision, he said that because the issue was whether under Humphrey v. Moore, how broad was the union's authority and responsibility to represent people. That decision did not deal with the question you had there, and you had it in American Airlines, that you have here. And what if the right of the plaintiff is derived from a statute outside of the Collective Bargaining Act? I argued that Humphrey v. Moore should apply, and the union should have both the right and the responsibility to represent employees. In Judge Fairchild's decision, he disagreed and went through every argument I made and said no, that when you have a situation where an individual is given a right outside of collective bargaining by a statute, that the union does not have the authority to represent these people because there's a conflict. Now, I would also say...
I'm totally lost. There is no problem in this case, I take it, about the permissibility of the union representing a teacher in the statutory proceeding. Because at least as is alleged, and there's some evidence, that the union represented at least two white teachers in these proceedings.
May I comment on that?
Sure, go right.
The trial judge held that there is no evidence of that submitted by the plaintiff, that it's merely a conclusionary statement, and is shown one of those people was not...
That particular facts occurred. Is the objection that it's hearsay? Of course, affidavits can be hearsay. They have to be based on personal knowledge of the sort that one could testify to at trial. Is that the point you're making?
No. The objection is that it's conclusionary without sufficient facts under your cases under summary judgment to constitute evidence which they're required to produce. And the fact is that one of these individuals was not in this union, it was in another union, and the other individual was not represented by the union, was represented by me. A union cannot represent...
That sounds like contrary evidence that would create a disputed issue of material fact. It doesn't sound like a reason for ignoring the evidence that the plaintiff actually offered.
But your cases hold that that is insufficient for the respondent in a summary judgment case to raise an issue of fact in defense to the motion. They've got to have sufficient facts to raise something. And in this particular case, a union cannot represent somebody in an action under the Tenure Act. It doesn't have a license to practice law. I can do it, and the record shows...
All right. Maybe this is just a quibble. Right. The plaintiff says the union represented them, and what you mean is the union paid for a lawyer to represent them.
No. There's no allegation of that. There's no allegation. I'm not sure it would make any difference, but I tended to represent people in these cases in various procedures. That was not under the Tenure Act. That was under a DCFS case. But I tend to represent these people in these cases because I'm familiar with it and I'm familiar with the law. But their relationship is with me, not with the union. And there are consequences and significance to that, because I have to explain to unions all the time that if the plaintiff's rights come from an outside statute, not from collective bargaining, the individual owns the case. The union does not own the case. And I tried in the letter to explain this to the plaintiff, but it was ignored. Anything else I can add? I do think the American Airlines case is significant, even though it's not directly on point. It establishes the genesis for this line of law, which was picked up in Illinois by the Labor Board and by the Illinois courts. The problem there was that Humphrey v. Moore did not, which came down the year after Title VII was adopted, it did not go so far as to explain just what the impact of an outside statute creating rights under which a union could be sued, what that meant in terms of the union's rights and obligations. And as I indicated, I'm the attorney that Judge Fairchild is referring to in that decision. And
the decisions are decisions of the court. They are not decisions of any single judge.
Correct. But he wrote it. I meant he wrote the decision.
It is irrelevant who writes the decisions of the court. You should not be making ad hominem arguments.
I apologize. I meant that he wrote the decision. And in the decision, every argument I made was specifically rejected. Ever since then, the law has been that the union, both federally and state, that the union has no responsibility to represent members in cases that arise under statutes outside of collective bargaining. We have followed that law. I disagree with it. I think the union should have a much broader response.
Counsel, can you point out to me where in the district court's decision the district court says that the evidence that the union represented two white employees in the Tenure Act proceedings was inadequate, no evidence at all? I've just reread the district court's opinion, and I can't find that conclusion.
It says it's conclusionary, and that you rejected it on that basis.
Can you tell me where, by any chance?
Oh, I'd have to dig it up.
I'll reread it again.
He cites your decision saying that it is the duty of the respondent in a motion for summary judgment is to come up with some specific evidence, not just to cite conclusions, and then he dismisses that allegation on this basis. Counsel has conceded the issue here is whether it is significant that the union had no duty to represent him under the law in this case. And that is that has been how cases have been decided since the 1970s. And respectfully, that is the principle that guides this case. And I don't see how you can say that a union must represent a member if he goes to the grocery store and has an argument as to the price of goods, and he wants them to represent him in filing a suit, that the union has any responsibility to do that. And whether or not the union represented somebody else with regard to that issue has no relevance whatsoever. It's outside of the responsibility and the authority of the authority of the union.
Thank you, Mr. Feldman. Mr. Smith?
I think the main point is, again, for me to focus on, first, counsel did not really go into the relationship that was adversary between the union and between my client, because in the letter that he had discussed, the letter did not contain that the collective bargaining agreement does not contain a provision requiring cause for discharge, and two, that the union cannot represent union members because it does not have a license to practice. That was not in there. The only thing was that there's an adversarial relationship that is formed between my client and the union. And I think that is dispositive of showing that the pretext was there, that there was a reason that they were not going to represent him. It's not that they were citing, we don't have a duty based on this is a statute, it's a 10-year. Well, there's nothing in the Collective Bargaining Act that says they can't represent him. There's nothing in the 10-year Act that says that the union, by its representative, can't represent him. With that, if there's any questions for the court?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Case is taken under advisement.